How can computational language help us decode the mysteries of nature and the universe? What is ChatGPT doing and why does it work? How will AI affect education, the arts, and society? Stephen Wolfram is a computer scientist, mathematician, and theoretical physicist. He is the founder and CEO of Wolfram Research, the creator of Mathematica, and Wolfram Alpha. He received his PhD in theoretical physics at Caltech by the age of 20, and in 1981 became the youngest recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship. Wolfram authored A New Kind of Science and launched the Wolfram Physics Project. He has pioneered computational thinking and has been responsible for many discoveries, inventions, and innovations in science, technology, and business. Dr. Stephen Wolfram, welcome to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you.
How would you describe the complex computation that is you? If you could go back a little to your early years where your curiosity began.
I've been fortunate to be able to sort of alternate between doing basic science and building technological tools so far about five times in my life. It's sort of an interesting thing because you build up kind of intellectual ideas in basic science, then you apply them in technology, then that technology lets you come up with new ideas in basic science, a cycle that can continue. But in terms of my own trajectory, I got interested in physics when I was pretty young, maybe 10, 11, 12 years old, and started studying it intently, discovered this amazing thing that you can just read books and figure things out. It was a time when physics was in a very energetic phase in the mid-1970s. Lots of things were being discovered in physics, and I got involved in that. And so by the time I was a mid-teenager, I was doing physics research and writing physics papers and things like this. But I had one important kind of secret weapon, shouldn't have really been that secret, which was that I was able to use computers as tools to do all the various kinds of calculations that you need to do in physics. And at some point, I had gotten to a certain point in being a physicist, so to speak, and I decided I was interested in sort of foundational questions about how does complexity arise in the world? Where does that complexity come from? And so that got me to think about computation not just as a tool for working out things that you already knew, but as something that could be thought of as a kind of intellectual framework in its own right. I had the chance to turn computers in the direction of the computational universe and see what was out there. What I discovered was a lot of things I certainly didn't expect, in particular, that even when you had a very simple program, very simple setup for the computer, the actual behavior of the program, the actual patterns that you generated could be very complicated. And I realized that's something that seems to be the secret that nature is using to make all this complexity that we see. And so that got me very excited about applying the idea of computation to things like basic science. And somehow, in the middle of all of that, knowing more about the essence of computation let me understand more about how one could build tools based on computation to work with the things in the world. And that led to my long-time effort that really started at the beginning of the 1980s to build a computational language to represent the world in a way that's useful to people. And that's what's now Wolfram Language, also Mathematica, these big software systems that get used by millions of people. And the essential idea at an intellectual level is how do you take the things that we think about in the world, whether they are cities or chemicals or numbers or different kinds of things, how do you take these things and how do you represent them in a uniform computational way so that you can both think about them more clearly and you can have your computer do computations automatically for you about these things. And so that's been one branch. Another branch is more on the basic science side of understanding this idea of computation. Just how far can we go in being able to work out how the world is put together, so to speak, and to what extent computation can allow us to understand sort of the foundations of how everything works. And so the big surprise the last 4 or 5 years has been the discovery that we can really drill down below space and time and really understand how the underlying structure of the universe gets put together in computational terms. And that's been an exciting and somewhat unexpected thing that's led to a lot of different directions just in the last few years.
Oh, indeed. And I love that curiosity, how the world works, and then taking the step further, how can we make it better? That's essential, that foundation. I want to talk about drill back or going back, talk about the other elements in your toolkit. I think it must be essential. Your father had, I think you were able to model a bit on his experience. You're a CEO and his business experience, or perhaps it went into your toolkit. Your mother was an educator. All these things, I think, might help with the success, these things that went into it at a young age for you to be able to see beyond academia to make that wider change in the world.
I think when I was a kid, I would have said of things I will do when I'm grown up, they're always going to be different from what my parents have done. My mother was a philosophy professor in Oxford. And when I was a kid, I would always say, if there's one thing I'll never do when I'm grown up, it's philosophy, because how can one be serious about a field where people are still arguing about the same things that they were arguing about 2,000 years ago, and there's no kind of apparent progress. But actually, the exciting thing has been that both in my work in building computational language and in my work in understanding sort of the computational foundations of physics, that it turns out that a bunch of those things that people have been arguing about for a couple of thousand years, we can actually say some real things about. It has been a long time trend in philosophy that sort of things start in philosophy and eventually turn into science and turn into things where you can make conclusions. And it's exciting for me that having observed these things that had been just points of discussion for a very long time, to my surprise, the things that I've discovered scientifically, have allowed one to actually get insight into those questions that have been around for a long time. Now, on the business side, yes, my father ran a company for about 50 years. I've so far been running my current company for 37 years. So there might be some sort of common theme there that, yes, one can have a business. I would say that I'm much more interested in the intellectual side of my business than my father ever was in his. I've managed to find an alignment of the kinds of things that I find intellectually interesting and the kinds of things that can actually be useful to the world.
Indeed, you render the invisible visible. And what I find really interesting is how computational language and Wolfram research is helping researchers and others solve real world problems. So it's exciting to think about progress and how we bring about the next stage of evolution for our civilization. And I know that's important for you. And more broadly, how can AI be used to help us solve, you mentioned cities, or do things like balance the energy grid or manage our, I'm just thinking just about cities now because most of us live in cities, or manage renewable energy and storage and transport. Resource management, all these things that we face, and how is that being done? And how do you think it could be better aligned with organizations and individuals and movements to interface and just bring about that progress?
I've been lucky enough to build tools that have gotten used by sort of intellectual leaders of a very broad range of fields. And so it's very satisfying to see that all sorts of inventions and discoveries and so on over many decades built on the basis of tools and the intellectual framework that I've set up. So it's been very interesting to see for lots of different fields, say X, field X, archaeology, zoology, whatever you pick, to see the emergence of a computational X for all X, and to see that our computational language can be used as the raw material, the notation for talking about things in computational X. And what does that let one do? In some sense, if we look at the progress of civilization, it's been a lot about things. It's like in the earliest great achievement probably of our species is the invention of a human language and the ability to describe abstract things in a way that can be communicated from one human to another. That's a great invention. And that's a way of formalizing the world. We have certain things that we think about in our minds or exist in the world at large. And the question is, can we find a way to transportably describe that, formally describe that? And the first step in that is human language. What happened historically, we saw other kinds of efforts to formalize the description of the world, whether it's with logic, whether it's with mathematics. Each of these things took us further in being able to operate in the world in an efficient, in a way that where we could take the things that we want to do and execute them with much more leverage. And I think this is a trend that we see continuing. It's providing a formalized framework for thinking about things and then adding as much automation as we can to to executing the things that we have formalized in those ways. For example, in modern times, it's popular to talk about artificial intelligence has been a term that's been around since the mid-1950s, and it's gone through a variety of different kinds of meanings and popularities. And in fact, much of what I've done in building computational language, computational tools, can be thought of as related to at least an earlier version of what people thought artificial intelligence was and would be, so to speak. But I think in modern times, the real point is it's about letting computers automate more things for us. There are a particular twist on kind of the notion of artificial intelligence that has to do with tasks that are very human-like tasks, like generating human language and so on, that have only recently become really accessible to computation. And as we go to the future, we can expect to see more and more things in the world get automated. If we look across human history, many things are just the same now as they ever were. And the way the human condition is, the way people are, has really been very much the same for a very long time. But the one thing that's changed in the course of human history is the development of technology and the increasing automation with which we can do things. And I think that's something we can expect will continue. And then what automation does is it shines a sort of brighter light on the question of, so what do you actually want to do? What is the thing that you as the human are determining the direction things should go in? Once you've determined that direction, the automation can come in and the giant industrial machine can progress in that direction. But the question, it's the AI, the computational system, whatever, it has no built-in sense of what it should do. There are an infinite set of possibilities. There's something we learn from my efforts in studying the computational universe is there's a lot out there. Most of it are things that we humans, at least so far, have not cared about. And the story of development of things tends to be, what do humans decide that they care about? In what direction do they want to go? What kind of art do they want to make? What kinds of things do they want to think about? What kinds of objects do they want to produce? There's an infinite collection of possibilities, but it's something that's a matter of kind of the human choice is which of these infinite things do we actually choose to pursue? And then our AIs, our computational systems can help us to be as effective as possible in pursuing those directions. But I think as there is more automation, there is more emphasis on this question of our choice. And in a sense, there is, in the computational universe of all possibilities, there is infinite creativity. But our challenge is to decide in which direction we want to go, and then to let our automated systems pursue those particular directions.
Yes, getting them all to mesh together and making sure it has that human alignment and broader ecological alignment so that we respect the boundaries of our planet. It's good to speak to many inspirational people like you or people who have done really extraordinary things in the science and arts or big organizations and multidisciplinary projects. They really care about their one corner of that they focus on. They come to a point where they hit a barrier where their knowledge can't be translated for other regions or to take action. We talk with climate scientists and their research is presented to policymakers, but progress is so slow. So how can Wolfram research be used to help streamline systems, just specific instances that you see this happening, or how do you see it developing in future to solve really important problems of poverty, mass migration, or the refugee crisis, these areas that have been outlined by the SDGs?
This is one of the features of being sort of upstream in the process of creating ideas and creating tools. One builds those frameworks and then people use them in lots of different directions in the world. The question is, how can you formalize what has to be done in a way that can be thought about computationally? You have some company, for example, it has all kinds of things that are going on, transactions that it's doing, products that it has, all these kinds of things. What is a computational or symbolic representation of those things that formalizes structure in such a way that we can compute with it? That's the typical path. And the consequence of that is, it's like before it was like roughly we know what's going to happen and this and that and the other. It's roughly this or that. And what we get to is something much more formalized where we can say, yes, this is something we can automatically figure out. It will take a computer a fraction of a second to work it out. And then we can go on to the next thing. And that's the repeated story is, once you can think about something computationally, formalize it computationally, then it becomes this thing that you can automate, this kind of brick for a tower that you can build. when you're just talking about it in, I've got words to describe this and so on, then it's something where you can't build on it. Once you have it formalized, then you can put it in as this kind of brick to build this whole tower of whatever you want to do. And I think one of the things that's been a limiting thing for progress in these directions is who understands how to think computationally about things. What I've spent a large part of my life doing is trying to provide the language in which people can think computationally about things. But there's still a human effort in being able to formulate what one's thinking about in these kind of computational terms. It's like one might say in an earlier age, can you think logically about that? You can think, or you can think logically in some kind of structured way that allows you to make progress and know that what you're talking about follows from the other things you're saying. And so that's one of the big challenges, is how does the world get to make use of the amazing power that exists from computation and the tools that I've tried to build with computational language and so on? How does the world really get to make the best use of that? And what we see in practice is a lot of kind of intellectual leaders in lots of different fields. Is it cause, is it effect that they are intellectual leaders in those fields? Is the fact that they're intellectual leaders the reason that they're able to start thinking computationally? Or is the fact that they're thinking computationally what lets them be intellectual leaders in their fields? I think both things happen. And I think that's a challenge, is to spread that more broadly in the world. And I think one of the things that is interesting is, for example, in the time since kind of widespread education has existed a century or a bit, there hasn't been a lot that has been invented. There are lots of specific discoveries that have been made and so on. But in terms of really different paradigms for thinking about the world, the computational paradigm is the biggest one that's come into existence since widespread education was deployed. And so there's a challenge now of how do you teach computational thinking? How do people become fluent computational thinkers? And certainly I've done a certain amount to make that happen. And it's really pretty neat to see whether it's kids or whether it's grown-ups, so to speak, get to the point where they are fluent computational thinkers and where they can take a thing that they're thinking about, an idea that they have, a concept for a company, a concept for making progress in science, take those ideas and turn them into computational language and let computers actually implement things automatically and then build these kind of structures on top of that. That's a really neat thing to see. And there are lots of things that people want to do, but it's a question of how do you actually have the capability to do them? And I think a big piece of at least the part that I've been able to contribute to is formalize what you want to do in computational terms, and then the computational language can help you actually do it.
Yes, its influence has been wide, and you've been so ahead of the curve. And bringing you to your book, simple question, what is ChatGPT doing and why does it work? A lot of people were saying that they didn't really understand exactly how ChatGPT comes up with the responses it does, but you've been able to clarify. Are there still some questions that you have about how it works, or what have you learned?
Gosh, it's a funny thing, because I've spent my life sort of building this big tower of science and technology. And every so often, something comes out of that tower that people say, this is a cool thing. For me, the whole tower is the thing that's really important. Certainly the most significant thing I've been able to do. And it's something that I've been able to see now over the course of half a century or so, how various ideas I've had and directions I've gone have actually played out. And it's been interesting to see that things which kind of at first were, oh, that's a direction that might be an artifact from the future, but it's not something for today. Gradually, these things have actually come into the things that people think about today, although there are plenty that I've worked on which are still 50, 100 years or more artifacts from the future, so to speak. ChatGPT is something that was not of my creation, that I didn't really expect was going to happen at any particular time, was being able to get an AI neural network system to be a fluent producer of human language. And that happened in late 2022 with ChatGPT. Nobody, including people who worked on it, really expected this to work. It's something that we just didn't know scientifically what it would take to make something that was a fluent producer of human language. I think the big discovery is that this thing that has been a proud achievement of our species, human language, is perhaps not as complicated as we thought it was. It's something that is more accessible to simpler automation than we expected. People have been asking me when ChatGPT had come out. We were doing a bunch of things technologically around ChatGPT because when ChatGPT is stringing words together to make sentences, there's what does it do when it has to actually solve a computational problem? That's not what it does itself. It's a thing for stringing words together to make text. And so how does it solve a computational problem? Like humans, the best way for it to do it is to use tools. And the best tool for many kinds of computational problems are tools that we've built. And so very early in kind of the story of ChatGPT and so on, we were figuring out how to have it be able to use the tools that we've built, just like humans can use the tools that we've built to solve computational problems, to actually get accurate knowledge about the world and so on. But people just kept on asking me, how does ChatGPT work? So I thought I'd better sit down for a week or so and just write some description of what I understand about how ChatGPT works and why it works. I realized that there was a unique niche there because there are people who know the engineering details, and I know a bunch of the engineering details, and there are people who have an interest in the big picture. And then there are people who have actually thought about the science of what's going on. And there's not a lot of intersection between those groups, except perhaps for me. And so I suppose for that reason, it ended up that my kind of week or two writing a little description of ChatGPT and so on has turned out to be pretty useful to people, which is nice. But I think the main thing we learn is that human language is not as complicated as we thought it was. It's something where we've known forever that there's a certain syntactic grammar to human language. We know that in English, for example, we typically will form a sentence with a noun, a verb, a noun in that order, and so on. But what has not been clear is we know it's noun, verb, noun, but which noun, verb, and noun? Which ones do we have to put there to have a sentence that actually makes sense, as opposed to a sentence that's just talking nonsense? And there's a structure, a calculus, a logic to how you put those words together to make sentences that make sense. We have never really codified that. Even back in antiquity, people were starting to codify that, but they never really finished that project. And so in a sense, it's been a little embarrassing to see that these neural net, where we've just fed them all these examples, trillion words of examples of how we humans actually say things as represented on the web and in books and so on. We've given those examples. And from that, just by pure computation, it's been possible for these systems to figure out something which, not in explicit terms, but implicitly figure out something about how you put words together to have them make sense. Now, is there a science to how that works? Is it just something where we say there's this big neural net that has all of these complicated numbers in it that all arrange themselves in a particular way, and in the end you get a sentence that makes sense? Is it just something which is an irreducible computation where we can't tell a big story about what it's doing? Or is it something where we can work out a scientific narrative about what's going on? Can we say why it did what it did? I think we're still somewhat far away from that, but we're beginning to be able to see some things about, in a sense, the representation of the science that emerges from the big picture of how we pick out a very tiny part of that. That is the way we think about things we're interested in. And there's a question of characterizing the tiny part that we've picked out. What's there? What's its structure and so on? How does it relate to the set of all possibilities? In fact, this is something that in my efforts in basic science and in understanding physics and so on, one of the really remarkable things that's emerged in the last couple of years is the idea that the laws of physics, the things we know about gravity, about space-time, about all these kinds of things, the fact that we perceive the universe to work according to these laws is an inevitable consequence of the way that we are, so to speak. That our characteristics are what cause us to interpret the set of all sort of computational possibilities in terms of the particular laws that we attribute to our universe. And the big discovery that got made, this idea of neural networks, is inspired by the way that brains are set up and the kind of electrical signals that propagate between nerve cells in our brains and so on. But it's an idealized version of that where you're essentially saying that there are these sort of artificial neurons and you feed some input into this array of artificial neurons and it ripples down through layers and layers of these neurons, maybe hundreds of layers of neurons. And at each step, it's being adjusted by these numbers, these so-called weights, that determine, in the end, what the output of rippling through all those layers of neurons will be. And the surprising thing is that a process like that is capable of generating fluent human language and text and so on. But the question is, can it be the case that a system like that, where you're training it by saying, let's adjust all these numbers, let's adjust these weights, let's set up these weights so that the system will correctly reproduce the examples, let's say the trillion words of examples that we have to provide it. And the big surprise that really became clear in the beginning of the 2010s was that if you push the system hard enough, if you give it enough examples, then it will actually successfully be able to reproduce at least certain kinds of things. What kinds of things can it reproduce? They seem to be kinds of things that we humans find it comparatively easy to do. Like we humans find it comparatively easy to tell a picture of a cat from a picture of a dog. We humans find it comparatively easy to string together words to make meaningful sentences. Those kinds of tasks, it seems to be possible to take one of these neural nets and by bashing it hard enough, giving it enough examples to have it follow through and perform those kinds of tasks. That's a thing nobody knew how difficult that would be. I looked at neural nets back at the beginning of the 1980s, and I couldn't really get them to do anything terribly interesting. And what nobody knew at that time was that if you just keep pushing, if you keep feeding more training data, if you keep doing more sort of steps of computational learning, then you can get these neural nets in the end to do very human-like kinds of things. And I think that's something that we didn't see coming. It's something where now certain things that we thought were human-only activities, we now realize can actually be done automatically. Now, there are plenty of things in the world of computation that are not human-like activities. The kinds of things that we do when we work out a particular computation, when we follow particular rules and we apply them a billion times or something, those are not things that humans do. They're not things neural nets do very well either. They're things that we can do when we have a formalized system for doing computation. It's the kind of thing that Wolfram Language does all the time, but it's not the kind of thing that we can expect us to do with our unaided brains or that we can expect a neural net to do effectively. So the thing that happened historically is that starting, well, in the 1600s and then really accelerating in the late 20th century, we got this idea of truly formalizing things so that we can automatically apply the rules and do that a very large number of times. It's different from the kind of branch of things that brain-like things can do easily. And what we've got at this point is this kind of interface that our neural nets, AIs, can provide that is human-like activities, human-like tasks, generating language, understanding language, things like this, separated from the things that are more formal, the things that are more apply these rules and see what will happen. Now, it's worth realizing that the natural world is much more on the side of apply these rules and see what will happen. The natural world is full of cases where it's the whole operation of physics, the whole operation of the things we see in nature, it's all to do with kind of just apply these laws of nature and work and see their consequences. And that's a different branch from what human brains do well and what neural nets and our modern AIs do well, which we don't really know how to characterize it terribly well. This set of things that have to do with typically reducing all the complexity and detail of what we see in the world to something which is appropriate, which sort of fits in our finite minds and which we can think in terms of.
I'm very excited about these developments in the way down the line we can actually communicate with the natural world or even understand animal communication, but that's distant.
The thing to say about that is there are all these different kind of nerve firings in our brains and so on, but we manage to somehow package up those things into language. We manage to take those neuron firings and create out of those things concepts that we can express in words that we can communicate to other human minds who can unpack them again and turn them into their particular neuron firings and all those sorts of things. But I think this whole question about minds and what possible things can be minds is an interesting question. It's one that I've worked on quite a lot. And I think the thing we realize is that sort of the processes that go on in our brains, those neuron firings, all those kinds of things, we can think of those as sort of computational processes. And there are many systems in the world that have complicated computational processes going on, a favorite example being the weather, which people sometimes say has a mind of its own. It is doing complicated computational things. But the point is that those complicated computational things, while they may be as sophisticated as the things that go on in our brains, they are not aligned with our way of thinking about things. They're a mind that is far away, as I say, in the sort of formalism that we've developed, in rulial space, in the space of possible ways of attributing rules to the operation of the universe. A way to think about it is within this thing we call the ruliad, within the sort of rulial space that is the content of the ruliad, you can think about different minds as being at different places in ruliad space. So two human minds that have somewhat the same background, have learnt the same things, they're pretty close together in ruliad space, and communication between them is not so difficult. They can kind of exchange concepts, and they expect that the concepts will be fairly well aligned between those different minds. As you get further away and you get to humans with very different backgrounds, or you get even further away to the cats and dogs and things like this, or the dolphins, it becomes more difficult to have an alignment of the concepts that can be packaged up from one mind to align them with the concepts of another mind. And I think as we see getting further away in ruliad space, we realize that the weather is somewhere out there in ruliad space, but pretty far away from our minds. The cats and dogs, we can have some sort of emotional connection to. There's some kind of things that we can readily communicate there. It's interesting to see when we have computational minds, AIs and so on, some aspects of those are set up to be very close to us in ruliad space, very much aligned with our kind of concepts and so on. But in general, computational minds can be arbitrarily far away. It is our particular choice to have AIs, for example, that are set up to be close to us in ruliad space, aligned in concepts with the things that we think about.
Hi, my name is Amy Chen, and I'm a third-year student at Columbia University in the city of New York, majoring in statistics and urban studies. Beyond the vision of the computational universe described by Stephen Wolfram, I was very moved by how much Wolfram emphasized the importance of using the capabilities of computation to address human objectives, which can be very wide-ranging, but they refer to what things are meaningful to us and what things we choose to care about. Wolfram's work has always been visionary. In 1988, Wolfram Mathematica was launched, which was a transformative tool that combined symbolic computation, numerical computation, data visualization, and a programming language into a single platform. Students used it to comprehend mathematical textbook knowledge, but the depths of this tool were a lot more sophisticated. Wolfram also published his book A New Kind of Science in 2002. He came up with the concept of computational irreducibility that could explain the complexities of a physical natural world and a conscious inner world. He described that simple computational programs, that of cellular automata, could explain the complexities of nature, including the apparent free will in human consciousness. You can read more about this in his book. But building on Mathematica and the new ideas of A New Kind of Science, Wolfram embarked on a still more ambitious project, constructing a system that would make as much of the world's knowledge as possible immediately computable and accessible to everyone. The release of Wolfram Alpha in May 2009 was widely regarded as a historic step that defined a new dimension of computation and artificial intelligence, and is now relied on by millions of people every day to compute answers both directly and through intelligent assistants such as Siri and Alexa. Furthermore, Wolfram's work on Wolfram Programming Lab creates research opportunities for students to learn and apply coding in meaningful ways. In a time where people are debating for a new social contract or some common political vision towards what an AI future could look like, Wolfram has emerged as an authority on the implications of computation and AI for society and the future, advocating for the importance of computational language as a bridge between the capabilities of computation and human objectives. And now, back to the interview. I was thinking about sharing my first experience using Mathematica and Wolfram Alpha. So basically during high school, I was very into architecture, so I would use your apps to try and experiment with and visualize different parametric geometries, often found in nature. With the proliferation of DALL-E, Stable Diffusion, Midjourney, and also the app that you invented in 2007, the Wolfram Tones, how would you characterize human creativity and algorithmic creativity?
First point is that there's a question of what forms can one create that we appreciate. It's very easy to make a never seen before sequence of random things. We'll look at them and say, this doesn't do anything for me. I can't recognize this. It doesn't relate to anything I think about. The thing that I realized back in the 1980s, actually, when I started studying simple rules and their consequences, was that's a place where there are underlying simple rules, but their consequences may be very complicated. That's like what happens in nature. And when we try and create, for example, architectural form, there's an interesting thing that's possible there. We can go from those simple rules, develop this kind of complicated form, but somehow we as humans are still used to, perhaps from our experience with nature, feeling that the thing makes sense, feeling that even though we can't say what the underlying rules might be, we still have the realization that there is something, there is some simple underlying principle behind the thing. And for example, in our Wolf and Tones project, that's a case where we're generating algorithmic music where sort of the concept, the rules are simple, yet the music, once you hear it, seems at least fairly complicated. And that's something which, that is, I think, a trick for generating form that nature uses that we recognize and appreciate, where there is something that underneath it makes sense, but in its development, it has a richness to it. And I think when it comes to architecture, there are a variety of different kinds of structures and objects which have been built using particular simple rules that I came up with at one time or another. And I think it's interesting to see how people relate to architecture that's created in that way. You mentioned parametric surfaces and mathematics. That's a similar but somewhat different branch, something that Mathematica does really nicely. And people have used it to build lots of kinds of interesting multi-billion dollar buildings with all sorts of strange shapes and so on. It is interesting that those shapes that come from essentially mathematics have a certain aesthetic quality, a certain kind of, yes, it makes sense, it all fits together character that we humans respond well to. Much better, perhaps, than we respond to buildings that have been just arbitrarily molded out of clay and then turned into big concrete structures. Those are things where it doesn't as obviously make sense to us as some kind of sweeping parametric surface where we can somehow have some intuitive sense that there was some seed of meaning to this whole thing, that there was some simple seed that kind of created the structure. Now, you mentioned the modern AI tools, the Midjourneys and so on of this world. Those are things that have been created from billions of pictures that we humans have said, yeah, these are pictures we like. These are pictures we're going to generate. These are pictures that are our way of representing the world. And it's certainly not at all obvious that one can take the essence of those pictures and present them back to us and have us feel that those are things that make sense to us. I think here's the way to think about it. That in the sort of computational universe of all possibilities, much of it is not anything that we humans have yet chosen to explore. It's forms of art, we could say, that we humans have just never touched so far. Historically, an interesting example is nested patterns, fractal patterns. Those were invented by nature forever ago, but they were invented by humans in the 1200s. But nobody really noticed. The art historians, when they commented on these patterns, they didn't comment on the nested patterns. It took until the 1970s and 1980s for people to really recognize, yes, this is the thing we shall think about nested patterns, to really identify that as a concept that people cared about. And then you have a whole sort of structure of nested patterns. Now, in the computational universe of all possibilities, there's a lot that we as humans just haven't chosen to care about, at least yet. So that's the whole computational universe of possibilities. Now we have the things that are made from that are based on kind of the concepts that come from the images that we humans have put on the web and so on, billions of images and such like. That's the raw material of the Midjourneys of this world. And I think the thing that is interesting perhaps is to say, given that raw material, what are all the ways you can put together that raw material? You can go inside a generative AI system and you can look at the big arrays of numbers that characterize the different parts of the space of possible images that you can get to from within those models. And one thing I was curious to do a while ago is to look at what's out there in that space. And for example, if you say, oh, make a picture of a cat, for example, there will be a place in terms of that sort of internal space of possibilities, there'll be a place where you get, yes, it's a picture of a cat. as you move around in that internal space, you get other kinds of pictures. Eventually, you'll get to a picture of a dog. But somewhere in between those pictures, you are in this kind of interconcept space, this place where you are getting pictures that are between the human concepts that we have so far identified. And there's a lot of interconcept space. In fact, the part of space, even within the things that have come from digesting images that are of human choice and humanly produced, even within that, it is just an unbelievably infinitesimal part of that space that corresponds to concepts that we have so far given names to. So in a sense, there's the space of pictures that correspond to things that we've given names to. There's the bigger space of things you can get to from extrapolating from the things we've given names to. And then there's an even bigger space of all computational possibilities. And now the question is, which parts of all of that are things that resonate with us humans? They're things that resonate with us today. They're things that might resonate with us in the future, and so on. We have a certain region of it that we've colonized, that we can talk about, and we're slowly colonizing, we're slowly exploring other kinds of areas. It's the same kind of thing that happens in something like mathematics. We know a certain set of theorems and a certain set of axioms about how we think the world should work. Gradually, over time, we get to explore further and further in this kind of metamathematical space. And it's the same kind of thing when it comes, I think, to the space of possible artistic forms and such.
Yes, it's so fascinating. And I want to go back to what you mentioned about the mind of nature or the mind of the universe or simple rules that can generate complexity. And it sounds like there's a spiritual aspect to this exploration, I think, like related to animism. Or could you just share your reflections on that?
I don't know. I have grown up in the kind of Western scientific tradition, so to speak. And what's interesting to see is that some of the things that the questions that we get to ask now that have grown out of the Western scientific tradition are things that have been also asked in quite different traditions. And so a thing that I didn't think we would ever have anything scientific to say about is a question like, why does the universe exist? But that's something that now we can make some scientific statements about that. And those statements have a lot of resonance, I think, with things that people have come to from very different kinds of ways of thinking about the world. It's interesting that when you describe, the convergence of science and other kinds of things. I know when I was a kid, people would talk about, at a religious level, they would talk about souls and so on. And one would say, that just can't be anything scientific. How much does a soul weigh? Anything that exists must have a weight. That sounded reasonable from the point of view of the narrow way of thinking about science at the time. Now that we understand this idea of computation, we understand that there can be a thing that is real and meaningful, but it doesn't have a weight. It is a merely abstract thing, a computational thing. And when we think about souls, that's, I think, the idea that one is going for is this computational representation, this computational engram of what's in a brain, for example. And we now have a much better understanding of what that sort of engram, what that abstract, it has no physical weight or anything like that. It's just an abstract thing that can be rendered in a brain. So that's an example. But I think it's interesting to me that there are things that people have an intuitive sense of and have for a long time, that sometimes in science, there's been a tendency to say, no, we have a particular way of thinking about things in science, and that doesn't fit with it, so let's lock it out, so to speak. So an example of that, for example, animism, you mentioned this question of where are their minds? Is it reasonable to think of the weather as having a mind of its own? Is it reasonable to think of the forest as having a mind, so to speak? In these kind of computational terms, yes, it does become reasonable to think about those things. Now, if you say, and it's then one comes to that idea from a place of sort of a formalized science, but nevertheless, it relates to intuitions that people have had for a long time that didn't come from that particular kind of branch of formalized thinking. Another example of this has happened with biological evolution, the question of the origin of species. How did we get all the critters that we see on the earth, so to speak? And there have been a kind of a, well, the critters of the earth are the way they are because God just built them that way and there's nothing more to say about it. And then the sort of shocker of Darwinian evolution of no, actually, there is a kind of progression of building these species determined by this process of natural selection. Then what happened is people said, that's the scientific view of how species get constructed and so on. It's all natural selection. And any other way of thinking about it just has to be something that should be locked out of the science. But turns out, something I've recently been studying, I was surprised to realize that some things I'd looked at many years ago, but hadn't pushed hard enough, we could now, using intuition from machine learning, using sort of intuition from the physics project that we've done and from the study in the computational universe, we realize that we can push further on this and to discover that in this sort of process of biological evolution, the emergence of all the critters of the earth, so to speak, that there's actually a bit more going on. There's natural selection is one piece of the story, but there's some significant other parts to the story that have to do with the way computation operates and the inexorable processes of computation that one might have been thrown out because one's got the idea science is purely about natural selection and nothing more, so to speak. That's a case where, in a sense, things defeat themselves by being too, we think we understand what science is, so then let's go only in that direction. I think one very big example of that is this phenomenon of computational irreducibility, this idea that even though you know the rules by which something operates, that doesn't immediately tell you everything about what the system will do. You might have to follow a billion steps in the actual operation of those rules to find out what the system does. There's no way to jump ahead and just say, and the answer will be such and such. Computational irreducibility is, in a sense, goes against the hope, at least, of, for example, mathematical science. A lot of the hope of mathematical science is we'll just work out a formula for how something is going to operate. We don't have to go through the steps and watch it operate. We can just jump to the end and apply the formula. Computational irreducibility says that isn't something you can generally do. It says that there are plenty of things in the world which are where you have to go through the steps to see what will happen. In a sense, even though that's a bad thing for science, it says that there's limitations on the extent to which we can use science to predict things. It's a good thing, I think, for leading one's life, because it means that as we experience the passage of time, in a sense, that corresponds to the sort of irreducible computation of what we will do. It's something where that tells one that the passage of time has a meaningful effect. There's something that where you can't just jump to the end and say, I don't need to live all the years of my life. I can just go and say, and the result will be such and such. No, actually, there's something irreducible about that actual progression of time and the actual living of those years of life, so to speak. So that's kind of one of the sort of an enriching aspect of this concept of computational irreducibility. It's a pretty important concept. It's something which I think, for example, in the future of human society will be something where people right now we'll think of it as this kind of geeky scientific idea, but in the future, it's going to be a pivotal thing for the understanding of how one should conduct the future of human society. Because the real issue has to do with, for example, when we build automated systems, AIs and so on, we have a choice. We can either let them do computationally irreducible things, which means they'll actually achieve something by the progress of their computations, or we can say, no, we want to constrain them so that they'll only do things which are computationally reducible, where we can work out what the result will be without actually for having it follow all those steps. If we say we only want the AIs to do things where we can readily foresee what they will do and make sure that those are things we want them to do, then we're preventing them from having computational irreducibility. We're preventing them from actually doing the things that they can do as computational systems. So the big choice is, do we let the things do the things they can do as computational systems and automate as richly as possible? Or do we say, no, we want to constrain them to only do things that we can foresee? So when we have this situation where they are doing computationally irreducible things, they will occasionally surprise us. They will do things where we did not foresee that would happen. And we have to decide, is that okay? Or do we say, no, we have to be able to predict everything? Do we have this completely controlled society where we can predict everything, but where a lot of richness can't happen? Or do we have something where There is a certain sense in which we can't predict what's going to happen, but nevertheless, many rich things can happen and we can make use of kind of the computational depth of what those systems can do.
Yes, indeed, it's an important moral question because there's the existential risk and, of course, what kind of guardrails need to be put in place to ensure the ethical implementation of AI. On this note about how we can cultivate our intuitive intelligence and the future of education, it seems like right now we're in a very autodidactic place. I wonder what your reflections are on what education will look like in the next decade and how do you think schools will evolve to help better prepare students and teachers for the future of work and the uncertainty of what lies ahead?
Education changes very slowly. I think it's one of those things in the world that has a great deal of inertia, for better or worse. I think that perhaps one place where one would like it to have inertia is to actually communicate the fruits of the development of our civilization. Sometimes I think education at some level wants to say, let's forget teaching about the things we learned in the past, so to speak. We're going to figure it out better right now. But then they use methods and paradigms that are very old. The content has been removed, but the paradigms are old. But I think what becomes possible educationally, I think we'll see whether AI tutors make it. We're trying to build one. The main conclusion from that effort, which we knew going into it, is it's hard. People assumed, oh, we have ChatGPT. It'll be able to be a good tutoring system immediately. It's just not true. It's difficult. It is, in a sense, it's a question of having the AI make a good model for the human it is trying to teach. And also, a lot of the strategy of teaching, one has to somehow set that up in the right way. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. It could be that will work and that we'll have the opportunity to have a lot more personalized education that can be executed with AI and computation and so on. I'm not sure. I think that there's a certain aspect of education that has to do with humans persuading other humans that things are exciting and worth learning and so on. And I'm not sure how that gets translated into kind of the AI setting. I think in terms of content, as I mentioned before, it's this question of how to think computationally about things. I've watched that process of injecting those ideas into education over the last four decades or so, and it's so slow. It's incredibly slow. It's slow on a timescale of centuries. I think that I've tried to do my part with all sorts of educational programs that we've done as a company, I've done as an individual, introducing small numbers of people to these kinds of concepts in an effective way. And it's pretty neat to see what those people can do. And now that's been happening for enough years that lots of careers have been built from those seeds. But it's something where the whole sort of vast structure of education as it's done, it's a pretty high inertia thing. And I think it'll be perhaps in time, there'll be more focus on teaching computational thinking in a way that makes sense. I think people say, oh, that means we get people to write code to write games. This is completely not the point. People learning how to poke a computer with in the low-level programming language that is intrinsic to the computer and have it set up to play some step in some game. This is far away from actually trying to think about the world in computational terms. And I think people will, it's somehow, yes, there is a new paradigm of thinking about the world computationally. And that new paradigm, like any new paradigm, is not so easy for people to reach. But it's funny, this concept of computational irreducibility, it will be 40 years since I invented that term. Some next couple of weeks, it'll be 40 years since I invented that term. And at the beginning, people didn't understand it at all. It's really a pleasure to see that a younger generation, for them, it's obvious. The world couldn't be any other way. And it's nice to see that. It is a challenge in one's own life to go from a thing one discovers to a thing that becomes obvious to one. There's a tendency for people who discover things to never really quite ingest them into their way of thinking so that they become obvious. I think one of the things I'm certainly aware of that pitfall, and so I try to make sure that the things that I discover that become solid building blocks for thinking are things that I really view as things that are then obvious that can then be built on. But it's been interesting to see over the course of, probably took, I don't know, 30 years or so, for another generation born after the concept was invented for that concept to start to seem obvious to them. And it's a pretty gradual process of explaining the concept of computational thinking and so on. I suppose it has now fallen on me to try to explain that and make a broader exposition of that concept in a way that can really be absorbed by people. Although the big thing that I've done is to provide the framework for thinking in those terms through Wolfram language and through the computational language that we've developed.
As you think about the future, the next generation and these frameworks, what would you like young people to know, preserve and remember?
This idea of computation is the paradigm of the 21st century. It is the thing that emerged in the 20th century and that we are just seeing the beginnings of its real consequences, both for how we think about the world and how we set the world up. It's a guaranteed way to be in an interesting place, to be involved in a computational X that is just now emerging, because over the course of a career, it will be the thing that rises and people can rise with it, so to speak. I think related to that is a thing that I learned very early in my life, which is use tools, learn computational language, actually get fluent with it. And it's the superpower that lets you go from just an idea in your mind to something that you can actually build out and eventually deploy in the world. You just start typing and then pictures are showing up on the screen and you're understanding what's going on. And it's a pretty neat thing to experience. And people who do learn tools and learn to be able to use these superpowers to get to places where you want to go.
Thank you. You've helped so many get where they want to go, and generations to come will learn from your discoveries. So thank you, Dr. Stephen Wolfram, for sharing your intellectual pursuit, the framework of computational irreducibility, and creating tools and a new kind of science that allows users to expand their personal horizons, experiment, and discover new ways of thinking and being to create a better society for all. Thank you for adding your voice to the Creative Process and One Planet podcast.
Thank you.
The Creative Process podcast is supported by the Young Michelle Xie Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Fang, Kanemi Chen, with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interview producer on this episode were Katie Foster and Amy Chen. Associate text editor was Nadia Lam. The Creative Process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. New music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you enjoy listening to this episode. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.